Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering radiation cancer treatment from over 30 physicians at 20 locations in the Charlotte regional area. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all. I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Dolph Ramser grew up on a dirt road in Concord, North Carolina, trying to keep from having to work in the cotton mills that used to employ so many Southerners, including many in his own family. He found his way out through his love of music, all kinds of music, but especially the folk and Piedmont blues of his home state. One night at a wine bar in Charlotte, he heard a young band called the Avett Brothers that sounded like a distillation of all the music he loved. He became the Avett's manager and has remained in that job as the band has grown to have a worldwide following. He also manages other recording artists and runs his own record label, Ramser Records. On this episode of Southbound, I talked to Dolph about the power of the radio, following your dreams, and the one gig he wishes the Avett's had played. Here's my conversation with Dolph Ramser. So Dolph, where did you grow up and what was it like there when you were young?
I grew up on a dirt road in Cabarrus County and in the Odell area. And, pretty much the area I grew up in, most of the people, like my father worked a couple years in the cotton mill. And luckily, and I say luckily, he got a job with UPS, which was life-changing for him. But most of the people were, how could I phrase this? Most of these folks were kids that were, or families that their mothers and fathers had worked in the cotton mill. They were the first generation that kind of were out of it, even though some people in the neighborhood still worked in the cotton mill. But I just kind of have to put that in there because I had so many family members that worked in a cotton mill.
And did you hear a lot of stories about that growing up?
Oh, yeah. I mean, both my grandfathers worked over 50 years in a cotton mill. My grandmother worked 45 years in a cotton mill. I had all kind of great aunts and uncles. And my uncle, my dad's oldest brother, Flavus, was his name. He maybe worked over 35 years in the cotton mill. So, it was my big goal in life, probably up to age 16, was not to work in the cotton mill.
Was there a lot of music in your house growing up?
Yeah, my dad in the early 70s was a big Johnny Cash fan. Johnny was sort of he was kind of the beacon.
Well, I left Kentucky back in 49 and went to Detroit working on assembly line. The first year they had me putting wheels on Cadillacs. Every day I'd watch them beauties roll by and sometimes I'd hang my head and cry, cause I always wanted me one that was long and black.
One day I if Tom T. Hall was on Hee Haw or Johnny Cash or whatever show, my dad would get my sister and I in front of the TV. And you got to watch this guy. He's one of the world's greatest songwriters. And then if Chet Atkins was on TV, my dad would do the same thing. You got to watch. Everybody come in here, watch. It's Chet Atkins. He's one of the greatest, guitar players. And then of all things, my dad was a big Pavarotti fan. So, yeah, to answer the question, yes.
And what were y'all? What were they playing that on?
It was all vinyl. All vinyl except my dad's pickup truck was a 8-track player. And we had a couple of 8-track players as well. And
do you remember the first record you bought with your own money?
First one, and I think I got it at Eckerd's, was because they used to sell records in Eckerd's and drugstores. And
sure.
I used to buy records at Rose's of all places. I bought Elton John's Greatest Hits. That would have been about 1975.
I remember when Rock was young. Me and Susie had so much fun. Holding hands and skimming stones. Had an old gold Chevy and a fence of my own. But the biggest kick I ever got.
Yeah, and that was at a time when Elton John was a rock star. He's maybe seen in a different light now, but in the 70s, he was a rock star. You know, and one big thing in our household, we watched Austin City Limits. Because I lived on a dirt road, we didn't have cable vision. So PBS was like the station, and we would watch Austin City Limits every week. And Hee Haw.
11 o'clock on Saturday night, right?
Yeah, and I remember seeing Steve Goodman about 1978 on Austin City Limits. And Steve wrote City of New Orleans, a big song, and he was good friends with John Prine. And then this station, WFAE, would have a Piedmont Blues show that I listened to on Friday nights that I listened to religiously.
Now, is that where you first got exposed to all that, or?
Yeah, because again, when you don't have cable and you're on a dirt road, radio was big. So I would listen to a lot of stuff left of the dial. Another station that was really big was Davison College. Their station is now all classical, but at the time in the early 80s, the students from like 8 o'clock at night, maybe 9 o'clock at night or so, to about 2 or 3 in the morning, they took over the station. So that was sort of my outlet to like new wave and punk. And then I kind of felt a kinship to that and Piedmont Blues. I felt it sort of went hand in hand. And then old time music from North Carolina, like music that was made in the 20s and 30s here. That kind of, to me, when I listened to the stuff on Davison College radio, the punk rock stuff, some of the stuff these old-time bands are doing in a lot of ways was kind of punk rock the way I looked at it.
Do you mean musically or lyrics or how?
I think just the spirit of it. Like, they're making music. They don't care if it's making money or not. This is an artistic outlet for them.
Did any of the... during that time start to occur to you this might be something you want to try to do for a living?
Well, I would make mixtapes for people. Like, I mean, I was trying to turn people on to music all the time.
Now, was this like for girlfriends or was this just for buddies?
Everybody.
Or?
Girl. Yeah, I mean, I would. I was crazy. I mean, I was a fanatic about music. For whatever reason, music has always been number one for me. I remember Philadelphia Freedom. Do you remember the song Elton John?
Sure.
Well, that got me in trouble one time because we were at the beach, and I'm not even sure what the venue was, but it was like a pavilion type thing at the beach there in Myrtle Beach. Somebody, I guess, had put a couple dollars in a jukebox and put Philadelphia Freedom 10 times in a row. Well, that was my favorite song at the time because I was an Elton John fan. I still am. So I'm like 6 years old. I hear it. I go from the beach up to the pavilion. Well, everybody thought I had gone into the water and nobody could find me. And I'm just sitting there listening to Philadelphia. Oh, my mother was really upset about that when they finally found me because they had looked everywhere. I mean, they maybe thought I'd drowned. So, but yeah. I mean, even at a young age, I was just always fascinated. Then, when you're from North Carolina and you realize this is the center of the universe when it comes to music, North Carolina. I mean, I can prove it to you on a home computer, as I say. There's just something about this state. It's been a melting pot with African Americans, whites from Scotland and Ireland and England coming over, and this mixture of music has created something really, really special, and it's made an impact on jazz. I mean, John Coltrane, Thelonious Monk are from this state. Doc Watson from, you know, from a folk. I mean, there's so many folk and bluegrass and old time and Piedmont blues, and it goes on and on.
So at what point did you decide you wanted to try to make a living in the music business?
Well, I remember in college, I took an accounting class, and of all things, this guy had a, the teacher, he talked about this record label in class one day, and I'd never bought any of the records. It was maybe like Blacktop Records. They might've been out of Louisiana. It was kind of a blues label. So I started putting some resumes together, and I sent some off, and I never heard from anybody. I just didn't know. I didn't know how to go about it.
So you're starting from zero. Like, you have no experience in any of that, right?
Yeah, and I wrote an artist named Martin Stevenson, who I later actually got to work with and still kind of work with. I wrote him when I was in college and said, I'd love to work with you. What can I do to get my foot in the door?
So what happened in those 10 years between?
So when I was a little boy, Billie Jean King and Bobby Riggs played probably the biggest match ever in the history of tennis. And that inspired a lot of people that really weren't country club types to pick up the sport. And that was my parents, essentially. So we started playing tennis when I was, I don't know, six or so, seven. And my dad was a good athlete. He was a good baseball player in Cabarrus County. And I guess I had a pretty good, had good hand-eye coordination and could run. And so I started playing tennis. So I think tennis, sort of from my parents' point of view, was my outlet, was my way to get out of not working in a cotton mill, have a better life. Davison College, the tennis coaches, both the female coach and the male coach, took me under their wings and started working with me, started coaching me. Yeah, that was the luckiest thing ever in my life to have them do that. Because I then, you know, when you grow up, I guess, in a mill-type mentality, and you then go to Davison College, and those folks are not from that mentality. It's a different world, you know. So tennis was such a big thing to me in my life as far as showing me another way of life, I guess.
And did you play there, or where did?
No, I just was coached there. And then, you know, I played junior tennis all growing up. And then I went to college, and my degree was in professional tennis management.
So did you at any of that point think, you know, you might make it as a tennis player, you know, like a tour player or anything like that?
Well, I was pretty good, but I kind of realized right away, nah, you know, I'm not the next Jimmy Connors. But, you know, working at country clubs, one thing you do learn, and you learn the gift of gab, because you have to talk to the member. You have to, you know, you got to make the members, you got to make them feel good. They're a member of a club you're working at. So you got to put on a happy face, even if you're not happy. And then also, you know, if you're 16 or 17 years old and you're taking five or six guys that are 50, 60 years old and they're business leaders in the community, you're taking them out on a court to play tennis with them, that's a good experience for you.
That, I guess, kind of leads me to thinking about when you decided you did want to go into the music business, sort of start from scratch. What convinced you that you could do it? You know, how did you think you were going to be able to swing it? Or what evidence did you have in your life that would work?
Well, I guess one thing, I didn't know that I couldn't do it. I mean, I really, and I also was at a position in life where I left tennis and I took a job with my father-in-law in the venture capital business. And sadly, after a couple of years, he passed away with lung cancer. So I was left really without a safety net. So I started thinking, well, I could get back into tennis, but really music's always been my true passion. Let's give it a shot.
And did it start with this Martin Stevenson?
Well, I had started a correspondence with Martin before my father-in-law died, passed away. And Martin was fascinated by music from North Carolina. So I brought him over in July of 2000. And we went on a little tour around North Carolina and the mountains of Georgia. And
when you say you brought him over, like, what was your pitch to him? Like, what'd you say you were going to do?
Well, how it worked, Tommy, is I ordered some CDs from him. Now, he was on London Records at one time in Europe and England. And London is a major label, and he was on Capitol Records here in America. So we're talking about someone that had a very good career. He had gone through the business where he was now not on major labels. He was doing it himself. When he noticed I was from North Carolina, he sent me this note, and it was like, he wrote this note about all these musicians from North Carolina that he was fascinated by. So then I sent him something back, and I sent him maybe some music of certain bands, and we just started this friendship. He later told me he thought I was about crazy, but that's one thing that kind of drew him to me, is because he had gone through the whole business of the major label thing, and this was just fresh, and I wasn't trying to make a dollar off of him. I was just trying to, let's make some great art and have fun doing it. And I think that was, he even called it like the major labels were the A roads, then you got the B roads, which is sort of big independent. Well, we were on the C and the D road. So, you know, I learned a lot from him, though, like asking him all these questions about the industry and how it worked. And him, Martin Stevenson, and Scott and Seth, to me, are the three musicians that I've met in my life that when they go into a room, they own it.
Coming up, we'll travel back to the first time Dolph encountered the Avett Brothers, back when they were still an unknown band. And we'll also find out why Dolph operates on handshake deals instead of contracts. That's coming up on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
So when you first saw the Avetts, had you heard of them before, or was that just a cold?
So my mother told me about them because an article was written in the Independent Tribune, Concord's local newspaper. Then David Childress told me about them, and he told me they were from Kannapolis. Now, if you're from Concord, Kannapolis and Gastonia are kind of neck and neck. Now, if you're from Kannapolis, I would think you probably think Gastonia and Concord are neck and neck. And then if you're from Gastonia, you probably think, well, we're better than Concord and Kannapolis.
Wherever you stand, you're looking down, right?
Yeah. So when he told me that, I was, oh man. I went to go see them at the Wine Vault, which is, a block away from where we're talking, and we watched the Avett Brothers together. And I remember, it was part folk, part punk rock, and everybody had a smile on their face, and the guys were a little ragged, but there was something there, and I can't put my finger on it then. I still can't put my finger on it. And I went home and told my wife, I can't really tell you what I even saw tonight, but you got to see them. They just had it. That was the first time I saw him.
So did you approach them that night, or when was the first time actually talked to them?
Yeah, I sent them an email, which I think Scott got, and Scott wrote me back and told me we're playing here at the Wine Vault. So I went up there. I did introduce myself to the guys, but just briefly, we talked just a second. And see, by that time, I was already working with Martin. I was working with David Childers.
So you could legitimately say you were in the business then.
Yeah, even though I didn't know what I was doing, but that didn't stop me, yeah.
So what was your pitch to the AVETS as to what y'all would do to you?
Yeah, I really wish I had those emails because I would be anxious to see kind of what they said. I just kind of recall that I was from Concord. I think that was probably my main thing. I'm from Concord, and I've got a record label, and I'm trying to find acts, and I've heard great things about y'all. And they were super nice gentlemen when I met them. And then, we talked quite a bit, and they had made a record, but they were actually going to sign with another label out in North Carolina. So they told me that. And I told them, well, if you ever need any help or anything I can do for you, just let me know. And for whatever reason, that didn't pan out. I think that other label wanted them to re-record some of the songs. And then they reached back out to me and said, hey, would you still be up to working together? And I said, sure.
So in those early days, what was your job as manager? And for them, what would you have to do?
Well, at the time, none of us really knew what we were doing. But I was trying to find them shows and venues, organizations, anything to try to get our foot in the door.
Hmm. I remember seeing you guys at Puckett's in Charlotte one time, and you were there with a briefcase with CDs in it.
Yeah.
And that was fairly early in the game.
Yeah, that was early on. That would have been 2003.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's about right.
Yeah.
So at what point along there did you realize there was kind of something maybe happening?
Oh, I knew it. I knew it the first time I saw him at the wine vault.
But when did you realize other people were starting to figure it out?
Well, it's a good question. I guess, I guess just whenever we would go to shows, seeing the reaction of people, I guess it was real immediate as far as nobody from the industry or nobody from even media. Now, early on, I did take a CD over to John Hancock. And, John is left to center in a lot of things. And luckily, and he saw something in the guys as well. And he took us up on a chance to get us on WBT. Now, I grew up, again, in this region. And to me, WBT was like the beacon. Even though they don't really play music, they haven't in maybe 30 years now. That was the station. So that was one of the first things I did. And John definitely gave some positive feedback, had us on, and that was big.
Shotgun, somebody get in my blade. Sally been laying with another man, he's sleeping in my place. Somebody get my shotgun, gonna shoot him sure as rain. You can run as fast as you want, boy, I'll kill you just the same. Somebody get my...
I remember that was like, I could just tell. And I remember telling my wife, all these small little victories that we were having, and they were tiny little victories. I remember once we sold 300 tickets at the neighborhood theater, or 400 or so. And it was like we won the Super Bowl. That was such a big moment just to sell that many tickets. And I felt like we can do this, around America.
Yeah, I was wondering if there's some point where you guys thought this maybe can travel,
Yeah, again, seeing them at the wine vault, I knew they had something. You put them in front of anybody. And one thing that I regret more than anything is I always wanted to get the guys up to the Apollo and have them play in front of the crowd that either boos you or they cheer you. If they boo you, you can kind of get off the stage. And it's an African-American audience. We would have won that crowd over, I have no doubt. I wanted that to happen. I just felt like that would have been a great moment. But we just, by the time we were up and running and up getting to New York City, that kind of had phased out. They weren't doing that anymore. But in my mind, I could see them. So, in my mind, I was thinking, let's get in front of just get in front of warm bodies, we're going to win people over. I mean, it's that simple. I mean, I've always felt that the only better live bands in America were Springsteen and Prince than the brothers.
Yeah.
And I've seen them play a lot. And very few times where it has not connected.
Okay, so I was wrong about my reasons for us falling out. Of love, I want to fall back in. My life is different now, I swear. I know now what it means to care about somebody other than myself. I know the things I said to you, they were untender and untrue. I'd like to see those things undo. So if you could find it in your heart to give a man a second start, I promise things won't end the same.
And at this point, you know, now that they've obviously, you know, known everywhere, what is your job now and how is it different than it used to be?
Well, I'm sort of in the same mindset of winning over one fan at a time and try to get the fans, the new fans we get, try to get them for life.
So how do you do that?
Well, I usually talk to our booking agent who decides, me and him decide where we should play, when we should play. I mean, the guys weigh in on this as well, but we kind of help with that effort. That's a pretty much a daily thing. And then when you get shows on the books, then you have to promote those shows. So we're helping with that effort, whether it's trying to help set up interviews, whether it's getting the promoter all the bullets in the gun he needs as far as photos, bio, making sure the radio in the market is taken care of. So all of those things. And then we deal, you know, when a record comes out, a lot of planning goes on before it hits the streets, and that's a big part of the equation on what I do as well.
Are you doing anything like day of the show, or is your job mostly sort of getting all that to that point?
Yes, getting it to that point. Now, we have a tour manager that's sort of, now he does a lot of pre-planning though on the shows as well, but the day of the show, you know, that's his world. Make sure everything is kind of taken care of during the show.
And so are you getting reports at like the next day, like here's how this show went or here's.
Yeah. And I keep up on the internet and, I mean, we've got the best fans. So, you know, I can pretty much look at, if I stay on Facebook, I can see the fans by this point have like made certain groups, on their own kind of fan sites within Facebook, and I follow those. I try to follow stuff that's going on YouTube. So I have a pretty much right off the bat know, you know, hey, if there's any kind of hiccups, typically we don't have very many.
I think a lot of artists and other business people too are kind of going out on their own, trying to figure out how to take that small few people who care about them and sort of make that into a bigger thing over time. Do you have any like particular secrets or things that ways that you did it that you thought, looking back, you thought, oh, we kind of stumbled into that sort of thing?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Yeah, you know, there's power in the small in a lot of ways. It doesn't always have to be bigger to be better. So I think I really feel like, I mean, we can always improve on what we're doing, but I really feel like we really take a lot of pride in what we do. One of the greatest things that we've been able to take advantage of is word of mouth. Because word of mouth in the internet age is often overlooked. And that has paid. Like, word of mouth to me is when a fan comes to see the brothers for the first time, and then he goes and or she goes and tells 20 family members, 20 friends, you got to go see this band. that's really how we did it. It's not been the internet. It hasn't been some social media scheme, or it's the guys busting their ass on stage, giving 110%, no matter if they're playing to 20 people or 10,000 people. And those people that come to the show that are spending hard-earned money to see the guys play, then go out and tell people, man, you got to see this band. There's something about them. You got to see them.
Is that something that's part of your job, is if, like, they're having a tough night or not feeling good or whatever, to sort of, like, be the coach, kind of give a pep talk now and then?
No, I mean, the guys are, I mean, I can't tell you how awesome Scott, Seth, Bob, and the whole team, the whole band, I've never known them not to give 110%. They don't need any kind of pep talk or any coaching. I remember telling Seth a long time ago, I remember seeing a thing about Joe DiMaggio, and he was asked, you know, well, why? It might have been a kind of a mindless game to where the game really didn't mean anything, and he's really hustling and sacrificing his body for a play, and they ask him, well, you know, why did you, you know, do that? And, well, there might be somebody that paid hard-earned money to see me play one time, and I want them to see me at my best. So they have that mentality. So that's never been any kind of issue.
And you work with them on, have always worked with them on sort of a handshake deal, right?
Yeah.
And was that your idea or their idea, or how did y'all come to that understanding?
Yeah, to be honest with you, Tommy, I can't really even remember now. It just sort of how it has been.
And do you do the same when you're working with like a record label or a something else? I mean, do you do all your deals like that? Or is, well, it just with your artists?
Yeah, with my artists, that's just kind of how I work. My word is good, and I've never had any issues about that.
I mean, is that important to you that it's done that way?
Well, I think at this point, that kind of benefited me in a way, because entertainment lawyers are not, they're not cheap. I just sort of felt like if somebody doesn't want to work with me, I don't want a piece of paper committing them to a bad relationship, and vice versa. You know, if some artist I work with wants to do something that I'm really not feeling it, then I don't want to really feel like I got to go along on that journey either. Mm-hmm. That really, it hasn't been an issue. I'm not telling anybody out there to do that, but I got into music to have fun in a lot of ways. You know, I just wanted to have fun, and this is a job, but it's really not a job. I mean, I'm so lucky I get to work in music. I mean, it's the thing I love the most. I mean, I've won the lottery as far as, man, I can't tell you how many people I know that aren't happy doing the jobs they do. And Lord only knows my grandparents slaving away in a cotton mill just so my parents, myself, could have it better. I mean, I'm so appreciative of them doing that. And so even though I feel like I'm lucky, I'm not taking my hands off the wheel and saying, you know, I'm not working on Fridays. And I was up at 6 o'clock this morning working.
Did you have, when you were first starting all this, kind of a vision in your head about how it might all work out? I guess I'm wondering how this has been compared to what you thought it might be.
Yeah, I mean, in my wildest dreams, I would have never imagined the success that I've been able to have. But I didn't even think about it, really. I don't think it's just happened, thankfully. I wanted to have success, but I wanted to have fun, and I wanted to release art that when I'm off this planet, my kids and grandkids can be proud of. And I was thinking more in those terms. Because I remember when I talked to Scott the very first time, I remember telling him, look, you know, I just want it, whatever we do, I want art to always be the top. Whatever we do, if it's, you feel like it's your artistic statement, if it sells two copies, and we're all proud of it, that's fine and dandy. That's kind of how I've been. That's probably hurt me in some ways. Not with the brothers, but maybe it's hurt me as opposed to being a little bit more thinking of the numbers. And because I'm putting out a lot of records that don't make any money, lose money. I just want to do it.
It is funny how that, for lack of a better word, Americana stuff like the Avettes do and Jason Isbell and those folks have really found a substantial audience
yeah.
without ever getting much, you know, the traditional kind of country yeah. or on the rock side either. They sort of found that sweet spot in between.
That's right. Well, in 1983, there was a band, and I bought the record, called the Violent Femmes. And they played acoustic instruments, kind of punk rock, kind of, in a way. So when I saw the brothers, I sort of felt like, wow, here is a modern-day version of a North Carolina Violent Femmes. You know, the Violent Femmes, their first, that record has been certified platinum.
Blister in the Sun and all that.
Yeah, and it never sold, I don't think it ever sold more than 50,000 copies in 1 year. But what would happen is each generation, like each freshman on school buses, would find out about that record.
When I'm out walking, I strut my stuff, and I'm so strung out.
That kind of music where it's left to center, it's not, a lot of stuff's never going to be on the radio, and I'm okay with it. Yeah, I'm a strange bird when it comes probably to picking out stuff.
So what's something you heard recently that really got you?
Well, you know, I have been really big into like Duke Ellington and Nat King Cole, Dean Martin. I've got some Nat King Cole records from the late 50s, early 60s. And I tell people, you know, it's like Jesus, Buddha, God, and whatever, Muhammad, all of them in a studio making this record. It just sounds like we have gone backwards. We have not really gone forward when it comes to audio.
Do you mean like the way it's recorded, or what are you talking
yeah.
about there?
I think it's the way it's recorded. You know, a lot of those things I'm listening to is lightning in a bottle. So they make there's one track by Nat King Cole. It's called "When I Fall in Love."
When I fall in love, it will be forever, or I'll never fall in love.
And I'm here to tell you that recording, they probably recorded it, I'm guessing, 10 times, 15 times, and it's all live. Maybe that's part of the equation of what's kind of going south. And I'm not saying all, you know, I mean, there's still a lot of great records being made. But some things, I don't know, you hear these things from the late 50s or early 60s. I've got a Duke Ellington record that's from 1950 that they had just come out with tape in recording studios, analog tape. I mean, you can hear the room. It's all recorded live, and you can tell it's a big room that they're recording in, and you can hear everything. And it's just, again, all these musicians are also, when they say we're rolling, they got to be on. There's no, I can go back and fix it. You don't have to play the take as well. You can, I mean, then it was your own. The clock is running, you know, we're burning daylight if you mess up.
Now, do you encourage the acts that you work with to work that way?
Not really. I mean, I can't even relate to that really. Even though, you know, I just had Joe Henry, he's a a really well-known singer-songwriter. He's a great producer. We just made a record with a band called the Steep Canyon Rangers that I manage and at the Fidelatorium, which is Mitch Easter's studio in Kernersville. And they recorded it all live. So, yeah, we still do that kind of stuff, but that's a rarity. I mean, that doesn't happen all the time. I mean, a lot of times it's, you know, you patch things in if you didn't get it.
Yeah. So you talked about those moments of listening to something that really captured you. What about in your career, just you've been at a place that was really interesting. You got to see something you never thought you might see with the Avets or anybody.
Yeah, seeing I remember when the Avets were playing the Grammys.
With Bob Dylan, right?
Yeah, and Mumford & Sons. And so that day when they were rehearsing, you actually go out to L.A. a couple of days before and you rehearse in a big sound stage. And then the day of the show, you run through the show. So you play, you do the show twice, essentially. One is a practice run and then in the evening it's live. The brothers are singing a song called Head Full of Doubt, Road Full of Promise. And Dylan's over to the side. I mean, it's their song. He's over to the side and he's mouthing the words to their song, which I thought that was a cool moment.
Yeah.
And that was really special. I remember my son, I guess he was five, maybe four. There's a syndicated show called The World Cafe, and the brothers have a song from an album called Mignonette. The song is called At the Beach. And I remember my son, I can still see him in the car seat and David Dye coming across the radio because we were listening to that radio show says, and here's At the Beach by the Avett Brothers. And my son had realized that I was not playing it. It was not a CD. He had realized, I think at this, recently in his life that there was radio and then there was CDs. And he was so excited that he heard someone introduce the Avett Brothers and they were playing an Avett Brothers song on the radio. I can still see him. What a moment.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much for talking to me, and we'll see you around.
Yeah.
Thank you, sir. In our interview, Dolph said he could prove on his computer that the center of the musical world is North Carolina. I'm not so sure about that, but I do feel comfortable in saying that the music most of us love is rooted in the South. The blues and gospel of sharecroppers and slaves, the bluegrass and folk music of the Scots-Irish. All those things mixed and blended and became country music and R&B and rock and roll. When you hear the Avett Brothers or Beyonce, Bruce Springsteen or Prince, you're hearing music that was born in our mountains and our fields. We hope to talk to a lot of Southern musicians on this podcast, but the truth is, just about every musician is Southern in one way or another. Southbound is a production of WFAE. The producer is Nick De La Canal, and WFAE's news director is Greg Collard. If you have any thoughts about the show, suggestions for future guests, or recipes for bread and butter pickles, email me at tomlinsonwrites@gmail.com. You can find this show and other episodes of Southbound at WFAE.org and most other places where you find podcasts. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, committed to technology-driven radiation therapy and treatments for cancer. Details at treatcancer.com.